I'm Christopher Lydon with Lawrence Wright of the New Yorker magazine. He's become a main source on peace and war in the Middle East, first as a reporter in The Looming Tower, a book about the roots of Al-Qaeda and modern jihadism, and now as a dramatist in his minute-by-minute account of Jimmy Carter's Camp David summit in 1978. It's called 13 Days in September. Two of the main players were sometime terrorists, Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel and President Anwar Sadat of Egypt. Their host, Jimmy Carter, is the lone survivor. He was the unpopular populist from Georgia who felt that God wanted him to bring peace to the Holy Land.
This was an event that was doomed for failure from the start. Carter had a really mistaken idea when he got Begin and Sadat together. He thought, these are two honorable men. I'll just take them up on that wooded mountaintop in Maryland. They'll get to know each other. They'll like each other. They'll trust each other, and they'll find their own way to peace. And after the second day, he had to physically separate them. They could not be together. They couldn't stand each other. Rosalynn Carter said she could hear them screaming at the top of their lungs. And, you know, there was no way they could make peace with each other. So on the fifth day, Carter had to do something he really didn't want to do, which was to put forward an American plan. And he had a yellow legal pad, and he wrote out 30 areas that needed to be resolved. And that was the first of 23 drafts of the American plan. He was constantly trying to shave down the differences. And both parties, both Sadat and Begin, threatened on various occasions to leave. One time, Sadat had ordered the helicopter. He packed his bags. And Carter told me he had never been angrier in his life. And he went to Sadat and he said, if you do this, America and Egypt will have no relations. Our friendship will be at an end. And Egypt will be alone and helpless in the world. It was a real come to Jesus moment from an expert on that subject. And then Begin, a couple of times, was planning to leave. And Carter told him, if you do this, I will tell the American people who's responsible. I will tell the Congress tomorrow that these talks collapsed because of your obstinance and your inability to make peace. He even had one of his speechwriters draw up a speech in which Carter asked the Israeli people to vote down their government. So this was a turning point because both parties, neither party could make peace with each other, but suddenly their relationship with the United States was on the line, and they could make concessions to the U.S. that they couldn't make to each other.
I mean, there's so many ironies that hang over this huge accomplishment in diplomatic effort. You say it's a almost uniquely successful negotiation. It's never been violated, the terms of the agreement.
The portion between Egypt and Israel in 35 years.
I mean, you could surely use this as a reason to, don't tell your kid to be a diplomat. I mean, you could get assassinated. You could get voted out of office. Yeah. You could have, you know, an Iranian revolution happen while you're not looking.
Yeah.
Not to mention, I mean, it's always seemed to me terrifically ironic that Jimmy Carter gave Israel its longest peace with its most important neighbor, and he's vilified, demonized. He's radioactive, as they say, in Israel to this day. I mean, what went wrong?
Well, this whole business of making peace is unusual and hard. There's a reason why it's so rare. It's extremely easy to start wars, but making peace is, you know, between two warring parties, very unusual. Hal Saunders, who was Undersecretary of State and was at Camp David, just before this began, he went down to the State Department historian and said, has this ever happened before? And the historian said, yeah, Teddy Roosevelt. When the Russians and the Japanese were at war, it was the first great war of the 20th century. Roosevelt brought envoys from each side to the Portsmouth Naval Station, you know, secluded, and hammered out a resolution between these two warring parties. And he became the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize. But beyond that, there's not any other example in American history. Later, George Mitchell in Northern Ireland would be a good example. But in the past, my favorite example was in the 15th century. I think it was Pope Alexander the 5th or 6th. Spain and Portugal were warring over, they were dividing the world up between them. And so the Pope thoughtfully drew a line across the globe and gave the New World to Spain and Africa to Portugal. But the line that he drew, he had an inadequate map, and he didn't realize that Brazil stuck out in across the line, and that's why they speak Portuguese in Brazil to this day.
Barack Obama is trying to advocate peace without victory all over the place nowadays. I mean, is it a viable idea?
Well, he's now leading us back into war, and my feeling is that, you know, if you look at the Middle East, everybody feels so discouraged, and the idea that Arabs and Jews can make peace seems ridiculous. You know, most people feel like they're eternal enemies, but Camp David shows us that that's not true, that peace can be made between these two peoples. We're in a spot right now where I think the drift of events is really dangerous. The conversation in between Palestinians and Israel has become so strident, and you know the talk of annihilation is very disturbing to me. And yet, you think about all the missing moments in the different mindsets, like when Begin was the most radically conservative figure that Israel had ever had at that point. He wanted to annex the West Bank, which he called Judea and Samaria, but he was going to award full citizenship to any Arab who wanted it. You know, it was essentially a one-state solution, something that you couldn't imagine gaining much ground in Israel right now. 25 years ago, you could drive from Gaza to Golan Heights without a single checkpoint. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, 100,000 from Gaza alone, went to work in Israel every day. You know, it's hard to conceive of that now because people have become, they don't know each other anymore. And they've dehumanized each other in their respective neighborhoods so greatly that it just doesn't occur to them that there's another way of resolving this. And this region is crying out for reconciliation and not more war.
What's driving the alienation, this extreme polarization, separation, hatred?
You know, when the nuances are lost and the actual encounters with each other, you know, the ability to see each other as human beings, when that disappears, then people are allowed to hate each other. And hatred is a very luxurious emotion. It's fun to hate people. You can put all the evil in the world on top of someone else's shoulders. And you can deny their ability to make peace or their love for peace. You can say that they'll never accept it. And that's the state of mind that I find so much now in the Middle East.
There are other things to note here. I mean, to me, the example of an American president staring down the leaders of the Israeli and the Egyptian nation, perfectly ready to yell at them, perfectly ready to correct them, perfect. Stay on the case. You're not leaving this room. Yeah. I'm going to tell you something. And our relationship, the American relationship with your country, is at stake here. Nobody's done that for a long time, and it works. Yeah. I mean, one of the things you conclude about both Sadat and Begin is that they were mad to maintain and improve their relationship with Uncle Sam.
Yeah, they believed that he was right when he said that your relationship with the U.S. was on the line. I don't know how much either Sadat or Begin believed when they went to Camp David they would come out with peace. But both of them had an interest in maintaining their relationship with the U.S. Sadat wanted to, he and Carter were very good friends. Carter used to say he loved Anwar Sadat. It's a term you don't normally hear in international diplomacy.
Romance.
But they were very close friends. And he hoped that the relationship between the U.S. and Egypt could come to resemble that friendship, and that maybe even it would overshadow the U.S. relationship with Israel. You know, that was his grand ambition. Whether, you know, Begin could make peace or not, the main thing he wanted to come out was with an improved relationship with the U.S. And Begin, he was only thinking he was going to be there a couple of days. He never expected to surrender Sinai, but he never would, except that suddenly Carter put America's thumb on the scale. And, you know, after Camp David, many Jews said that Carter had bullied Israel. And that, you know, he became the first Democratic nominee when he was running for re-election not to have a majority of the Jewish vote. So this antipathy toward Carter that you see so strongly expressed in many circles really began then when Begin said that he had been forced to sign. Yet Begin wanted peace and Sadat wanted peace. They had to have a party that would force them to do this. You know, if you go to Israel and Egypt, you'll hear how unloved this peace treaty is by both sides. But to me, that just indicates how hard it was, what, you know, the sacrifices they had to make in order to achieve it.
Come back to this Sadat piece, which runs through your book as a kind of hint that, wait a sec, for Sadat, this is all about making a big geostrategic switch. Yeah. The Soviets are gone. Nasser's gone. He wants to marry the United States, and this is what he's going to have to do. There are moments when he says, do what you want with the Palestinian thing. If you'll give me back the Sinai, I'll do anything you want.
Yeah.
This was a man who, as you're right, had wanted to be an actor. He was a dramatic personality, believed in all sorts of transformations and whatnot. But the transformation he was really interested was in the American connection.
Well, you know, Sadat saw himself in pharaonic terms, as is typical of Egyptian leaders, unfortunately. There's always this idea that there's, you know, a need for a strong man. And I was living in Cairo. I was teaching at the American University when Sadat became president. And everybody thought he was a clown. He had missed the revolution. He'd been at the movie theater, a double feature. But you know, nobody believed that in the shadow of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the most titanic figure in Arab history,
talking
modern
pharaonic,
Arab, yeah. That, you know, that Sadat could stand in the wind, and yet within a year he'd taken all of Nasser's corrupt cronies and put them in prison. There were no diplomatic relations with the U.S. at that time, so there were only a couple of hundred Americans in the whole country, but there were thousands of Russians, and 15,000 Soviet military advisors, and he threw them in out of the country, and that was stunning and unprompted. You know, the Americans couldn't believe it. It was one of the greatest victories in the Cold War, and we had nothing to do with it.
But it let Egypt become a sort of showplace for crony capitalism too, especially under Mubarak and his sons. I mean, this has to be counted among the effects of Camp David.
You know, Egypt, when I lived there, was a very poor country, and it is now a less poor country with a lot of wealth that wasn't there before.
Double the population.
You know, when I lived in Cairo, there were 6 million people, and of course, it's always an estimate, you know, guesstimate.
Right.
In Egypt.
Over 20.
Immense growth. No, it's 2006. I was there, and I was making a speech at at Cairo University, where Barack Obama later made his famous speech. And a young woman asked me, what happened to Egypt? Why didn't we progress?
Amen.
And when I was there, you know, Egypt was about on the same level as South Korea, India, Singapore even. These were all developing countries, and they developed, and Egypt really did not. And I said, I think it takes a generation. Just as, you know, in the Great Depression in my country, my father was on the Dust Bowl in Kansas, and then, you know, that greatest generation, as we call them, really transformed America into the most powerful economy. the world has ever known. And similar generations are there in Hong Kong and Indonesia. You know, you see all these countries raising up. It's going to take a generation like that in Egypt. And I think that generation went into Tahrir Square. And I don't think they're finished yet. There is a revolution that is yet to be finished in Egypt, and I hope and pray that it comes about.
Yeah. All I mean to say is it's a revolution in some part against all sorts of things that Anwar Sadat embodied, as well as the beauty of the man and his daring.
Yeah. But now, on the other hand, just consider that Egypt and Israel, as little loved as this treaty is, those two countries are closer together now than they ever have been. And it wouldn't have been possible without that treaty.
Lawrence Wright's book, based on his play with the same name, is 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. I'm Christopher Lydon. You can hear more conversations on arts, ideas, and politics at radioopensource.org.